Welcome to the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose.
More than 400 years ago, a privateer ship called the White Lion brought the first enslaved people to Virginia. That's part of a legacy that Delegate David Reed thinks should be taught in Virginia schools.
The founding of democracy and slavery in Virginia and in the United States are so intertwined, and it's important for us to be able to teach that history.
Do you think that history is not being taught?
I believe it is not being offered and taught in the level of detail that you would be able to get out of dedicated courses.
That's why he introduced a bill that would allow high school students to get credit for taking Black history courses. Senator Schuyler Van Valkenburg is a high school civics teacher when he's not in the Senate, and he tweaked the bill to make sure that the graduation credits apply to every district.
There are certain classes that are important that you take in history, you know, United States history as an example. But I think when you're looking at some of the other verified credit options, World History I, which is ancient history, World History II, which is modern world history, I think United States African-American history is another good alternative for that verified credit as well.
Reed had a similar bill last year, but it was vetoed by then-Governor Glenn Youngkin.
It was when President Trump was attacking diversity, equity, and inclusion. So I don't know what the governor was thinking, but my assumption is he felt like he had to play his role to be subservient to Trump.
The House of Delegates will be considering Van Valkenburg's changes to Reed's bill this week. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
Okay, and so joining us for our discussion today are
Dana Ackley, author of A Little Book to Save Humanity.
Jay Foster with the Praxis Way.
William Fralin, former member of the Virginia House of Delegates.
Catherine Elam, former director of junior achievement at Southwest Virginia.
Cynthia Lawrence, head of workforce development at Carilion Clinic.
Joyce Waugh, former president and CEO of Roanoke Regional Chamber.
Wayne Strickland, former executive director of the Roanoke Valley Allegheny Regional Commission.
Michael Brockta, CIA retired and recent president of the Kiwanis Club of Roanoke.
Okay, so the story is pretty clear. I knew that African-American history was offered in our public schools, particularly at the high school level, but I didn't know maybe it didn't count for credit. So that was interesting to me.
I really think it makes sense with other history courses that are taught that are given credit that this would be given credit as well and may need to be expanded to do that. But there's so much we don't know. And like so much of history, it is usually written by those who were in charge at the time.
Right. And I suspect we're all in pretty much agreement here that it should be taught in public schools. And so some of this I'll devil's advocate maybe, but is it important it has its own subject matter, or is African-American history part of American history that should be taught along with, you know, your basic American history survey course? Mike?
I'm not looking at this at the moment through the lens of is it good or needed or useful. I'm looking at it through the lens of who gets to make the decision. Are we looking at the state making decisions for our local school systems? And if we are, that sort of balance is been spoken about quite a bit the last couple of years. There have been a lot of activists arguing for who gets to draw the line, state versus local versus parents. I'm interested in teasing that out a bit.
Yeah, it's a constant tension. Wayne could probably speak to this given his background, but it's a constant tension between what the state tells the localities to do and what the localities can do on their own. And so there are curricula requirements that the State Board of Education puts out. I haven't seen this bill. If I had to look at it, I suspect it's drawn to those criteria that the state board has to put out and how they have to recognize accreditation and credit for graduation, a certain number of credits you have to graduate.
That's right. So looking at that just for a minute, there are limited time windows for students to be able to take courses that count for graduation credit. And every district has autonomy to make their own decisions about what courses are offered. When the Virginia Department of Education comes up with courses and offer them to the districts, sometimes they are taught, sometimes they are not taught because they don't have an instructor or they don't have equipment in certain cases. So they would certainly have to have a qualified instructor to teach such a course. I think I'll go back to your original statement. I think it absolutely should be offered and taught. I think it's a resourcing issue for every district. Some districts will have more resources to put towards that than others. But I applaud the idea that it should be counted for credit. I think that the scheduling issue on a district-by-district basis is going to need to be looked at in order to support should the legislation pass.
So the former governor was apparently didn't think it was necessary because he vetoed the bill. So we have a new governor, and my suspicion is she will not veto the bill and sign it and think it is necessary. So to your point, sort of setting forth what's expected at the school systems from the state. Sure, Dana.
Cynthia, what happens if a school system does not live up to what the State Board of Education says is required?
Well, I can't speak in detail about that, but when the VDOE puts forth their criteria for graduation or school performance, every school needs to strive to meet those requirements.
And so this is an issue that has gotten politicized, and if I happen to fall on one end of that continuum and decide I don't think this is a good idea, well, then I just don't have the resource for it. I mean,
I'm not sure it works quite that way. The state board does have certain criteria, and of course the state funding is something that can be held up. So there are consequences.
Thank you.
But to your broader point, whether somebody's watching that or not would be an interesting issue. Elaine.
Well, my question would be who does the curriculum? Who approves the curriculum? And in our environment, the curriculum before over the past few years has been reviewed, have to be reviewed, and before a decision is made if it's okay to be in the schools.
Yeah. I believe the state board, but Catherine, you right. probably know a lot about that from junior achievement.
Well, again, you usually are going back to Richmond in this case, and they usually are setting the parameters. They send it back to the school systems, and for every school system, there's going to be a director of, let's say, history. And that history individual is supposed to look down at each school and figure out what they can do. Again, it goes back to the resources. But more importantly, as you look at it, I know there's these longer terms. For instance, right now, I bet the pressure is that we're looking as a country to celebrate 250 years anniversary. So part of that is to go back and be realistic about how the country was built, what segments are missing, and what can you do. I know some of those things. I'm not positive that all the high schools have always had Afro-American studies, but they have been a part of American history. They always will have maybe a month dedicated where they're doing something. But again, we do need to be able to expand the horizons. It goes back to what Cynthia was saying. You have to have the people in there that have the credentials to be able to teach that as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just thinking back on my high school, junior high school, and I never heard of Oliver Hill till I was out of law school. And his importance in the civil rights struggle and being born and raised in Roanoke sort of points to the need. We might need something like this, but go ahead, Mike.
And I want to argue a contrary point of view just for a second. So local news here in Roanoke, almost every week we're hearing issues with the funding for the city school system, right? I haven't read quite as much about the county recently, but certainly the city school system is being told to do more with less, less with less. I mean, certainly less. So why are we thinking about coming along and piling one more requirement on a system that's struggling under the weight? I'm confused.
So you raise an interesting point. There's nothing in the law that says you can't teach this. I think what they're saying is it will count towards accreditation, which is a little bit different because I do suspect it's being taught. I don't know in Roanoke City Public Schools, but I suspect it is. And that's a good thing. But you want to weigh in, Jay?
Well, it's interesting. I was recently in a meeting about the shortfall in the school system's budget in Roanoke City. I'm not sure what it is in the county, $16.5 million. So I just saw an article they're going to have to cut 150 positions today. So if this was a mandate, and I thought in that recording it was like we're going to make this a mandate across the state.
That's what I heard.
Then that's an unfunded mandate, and that's a whole different problem. But then back to the real spirit of this discussion, DEI and the question of why are we teaching history to begin with? What's the purpose of teaching history? And in Roanoke City, given our urban population, 20% African-American, I think promoting that kind of education gets kids engaged. They want to learn.
Cynthia?
And let me play off of that too, Jay, because I think the core purpose of education is to inspire young people to see themselves participating economically, professionally, socially, and civically, I think. And so to that end, making sure that we are teaching a holistic view of the history of our country, to your point, Catherine, I think is very, very important. And I think young people can find inspiration in stories that may be taught from their own community's perspective and looking at people who have gone before them as mentors and examples that they can live up to. And I'm just going to say one more thing about the example that you gave, William, about not knowing about Oliver Hill mm-hmm. until you were an adult. Mm-hmm. Right now, there is a wonderful exhibit at Melrose Plaza in the Harrison Museum of African American mm-hmm. History on the medical contributions of mm-hmm. African Americans in this region. And they are numerous and plentiful and deep. And those stories do need to be told.
Sure, Dana.
You talked, Cynthia, about inspiring young people. Another part of education is what kids are working on in a great degree is figuring out who in the world they are, developing an identity which will guide them in their lives. And history is clearly a real part of the essential part of figuring out who we are. As Carlos Castaneda said, he who doesn't know history is doomed to repeat it.
Well, just do a quick reset here. You're listening to the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show on Radio IQ, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose. You can follow us at roanokecollaborationproject.org, and you can also explore our constructive dialogue pledge there. Catherine.
I was going to add to that whole thing about knowing the people in our community. A lot of history is about the storytelling, and so a lot of times people and students, grown-ups for that matter, remember the stories that are being told. And so these are things I think that are going to be very important in the Afro-American history. It's been told many ways, but we want to get an accurate reflection of what those times were like. And I think even in this area, for instance, we talked about the Melrose Plaza having its display. There are others in the community outside of medicine. There were a lot of entrepreneurs in this area that did things that people are not aware of and made a difference in the community. And I think so often there's just this quick snapshot, unfortunately, of a lot of sports people that, you know, they did well, but you can't all do those things. So let's give some other positive feedback and making sure. And that's what the history is about. It's rich. And I think people forget that this is a piece of what makes students engaged in school to know that they have those possibilities and having examples.
You know, I saw today in the Roanoke Rambler, there was an article, an interview with a historian at the African-American Harrison Museum, African-American Culture. And I read that story and I hadn't really thought of it this way, but she was sort of, you know, what she said was, you know, ending segregation is the right thing to do. At the same time, it had an adverse impact on African-American culture, and that's sometimes not recognized. And that's maybe a place where this might help. Yes, Wayne?
Well, you know, what Cynthia was saying and what Karen was saying is true. If you look at a textbook, you want the children to see that there are opportunities. And if you don't see them as in medicine or in science or as an entrepreneur, then you may not think that you have the capability to do those kinds of things. So it has to do with workforce.
Sort of the model. We all had role models when we grew up.
Right.
And if all you see are sports figures, to Catherine's point, and not people doing other things, maybe you don't think you can do those things. So it makes sense. Yeah, Mike.
You know, I want to play the role of a contrarian here just for a minute.
You're fit for it.
Well, thank you for the compliment. You know, I think we're taking the easy way out in this discussion. Again, I'm trying to be a contrarian here for a minute. I think we're taking the easy way out. In other words, we're arguing about the quality of good. Right? Education is good. We're sitting around the room arguing about how good it is. Okay, but where's the money coming from and where are the resources coming from? I mean, it's too easy to pile one more requirement on an overworked school system or an overworked administrator or teacher and not give them the opportunity to take something off the table to balance it out, right? Right. I'm trying to provoke a discussion about how do you deal with the fact they can't afford this?
Yeah, it's a real question. It's a real problem. I don't know any of my fellow ex-public servants who ran on, I took this away. They all run on, I added this. So it's a structural problem in some ways. You've also got a very complicated school funding formula in Virginia, where localities like rural localities in general are subsidized by Northern Virginia. And so the state pays more of a share for their required classes. And remember, when you make it part of the mandate, now it's required, and then the state pays a portion of it. But if it's not required, then you're doing that on your own, is the way I understand the school funding. Yep.
Well, let me ask a clarifying question.
Help me if I'm doing it wrong.
Well, no, you're right, but let me ask a clarifying question. Did I understand the story to actually just say that the course would count for credit towards graduation, not school accreditation? That's two different things.
That's a big difference.
It's a huge difference. So I want to make sure we're talking about the same issue here.
Yeah, what I heard was that you can get course credit for it,
right?
But it isn't a mandate that you teach it.
Right.
I think that's what I heard in the story, which would speak to Mike's.
I'm sitting here thinking I should have listened to the story a little closer.
I'm going to take the contrarian view again. In my contrarian view, it matters not whether it's a mandate or not a mandate. It's still an opportunity for a school system to spend time and resources on something they can't afford. And the funding formula that we talked about has resulted in the current situation where I don't believe any school system has raised their hand and said, nope, I got enough funding, I don't need any more. So they're all under challenging funding conditions. And mandate or not, that's all I have to say at the moment on that issue.
Well, and it does, you know, I and you got to be careful. This is obviously a hot button issue, right? Because this is really timely, really, you know, the DEI thing. The DEI came up in the story about, well, Youngkin didn't, I guess he didn't like the DEI aspect of it or whatever. I think the senator or delegate said, and whether that's true or not, I don't know. Obviously, he vetoed the bill, so he didn't like it for some reason. But that does, there's an old saying in the law, bad facts make bad law. And you're trying to take, Mike, a situation where you're probably agnostic as to what it is, but it is another thing, is what I'm hearing. You're not saying it's good or bad. You're saying it's another thing, and what can we cut? And I do think we have not really discussed what we want our public schools to do. We mandate nurses. We mandate they have breakfast. We have lunches. We've got transportation. You know, and I'm not that old. I'm only 63. But I used to walk to school. I didn't have a bus. We sure as heck didn't have a nurse. I mean, you know, now there were probably some things that weren't great about the school too, but I don't know. I mean, I think it's not without legitimate point, Mike. Dana.
We spend money on what we value. And it's
good
pretty
point.
Much that simple. If you see, you know, if there's a difference between somebody's words and somebody's behavior, always believe the behavior. And spending money is behavior.
Yeah, that's a fair point. It's a fair point, Mike.
I'm still playing the contrarian role, Dana.
You are well suited for it.
Thank you. So I came out of the federal world as a CIA employee, and I spent quite a bit of the taxpayers' money, all right? In that world, we never had a discussion about how much we needed to accomplish unless we had the other discussion at the same moment in time, how much can we afford? There was always that balanced discussion. You only agreed to accomplish something if you had it in your budget to do it. And so here I hear mandates or not mandates. I hear a distance between those halves of the conversation.
Right.
What do we want to accomplish and what can we afford? So Dana, I'm trying to paint you into a corner on your view that we only fund what we can afford. I don't think so. I think we fund a lot of things we can't afford because of that separation.
Well, I didn't say afford. I said value.
Well, and then there's probably a peanut butter effect, but my understanding of the CIA budget is nobody's allowed to look at it. So it's a black budget, right? So, Catherine, you wanted to jump in here?
I just want to say again, you know, we have to look at how we deliver our programs in the area. I'm sure that, you know, partly this goes back to understanding the dynamics and the terms of the population of our schools and what they look like. I know that's how the dollars are doled out. They look to see what the population is. But the other part of that is, if you look at the academic performance of each one of these schools, and what else do they need to be able to be there? I know recently I saw, I'm very proud of our little elementary school in Salem, G.W. Carver, and they're now Blue Ribbon State School because they're taking the time to engage the students the minute they walk in the room. And that's the thing that I think we have to look at. Even though if it's a mandate or what's going to be accredited, I do think that as a student, as you go through K through 12, these are the formative years. You're hoping to be able to be suited to be able to work with others. And I think that's why this whole thing is coming up. We've shut down DEI because we supposedly don't want to know about what other people look like and what they've been able to contribute. But it does matter in terms of how we get along with each other in the workplace. And then again, what can we give back? And what kind of education are we going to have? A lot of people are destined to go to a four-year. A lot of our students that we have are going to go to trade school. They're going to go to, you know, community colleges. They need to know what options are there for them. And you should be able, long time, what we used to say in JA is follow their passion. What is it that you do well? And can you figure out that trail to how you're going to get to that point where you can succeed, run your own business, or do whatever else that you think you can do for your community?
Mm-hmm. Cynthia?
Let me just pick up on that, Catherine. Schools are always under tension between their fundamental responsibility of creating a well-rounded human being outside of the family structure. And then there is the pressure from the marketplace to bring me students who have skills that are ready to enter the workplace. And so there's always this tension between those two philosophies. And balancing the resources, Mike, to your point, is always the question. But I don't think we can sacrifice the development of a human being's mind and creating the inspiration in those students to continue to learn and opening up their passions for pursuing a profession that they might wish to know about further. So while it is a tension, while the resources are precious, I do think that in K-12 particularly, it is about developing a fundamentally developing a well-rounded young person to continue on.
And if I could add to that, as a psychologist, I can assure all of us that approximately 100% of people are flawed, deeply flawed. Mm-hmm. And so our history, as
probably
we study...
Probably good for business.
Beg your pardon?
Probably good for business.
Well, but our history needs to reflect that, because as we think about the children, as Catherine and Cynthia are talking about, if we give them a, forgive me, whitewashed version of history, and they know they can't live up to that, we have not developed a well-rounded human being. We have helped them be even more flawed. So we need to be able to accept our history as it is.
Jay?
So back to what Mike was highlighting and what you were saying, Dana, what do we value? In this group, we've talked a lot about some of these principles of being in a community, having each other's backs, as Bill D would say, and really workforce. And so what strikes me is it's probably not a one-size-fits-all. My opinion, if this question of a mandate, shouldn't be a mandate. I think in a city like Roanoke, with a 20% poverty rate and 20% African-American population, having these classes is exceptionally important. And teaching people and modeling, we've heard that in this group before, modeling what we want to show people to say, this is what it looks like when it's done well.
Isn't it important for, I was going to say middle-aged white man like me, but that's not the case anymore, to know about Oliver Hill, right? I mean, so yes, it's African-American. Yes, it may not have a direct impact on me, but it has a direct impact on how I see the world.
Oh, sure. I think you definitely. But back to Mike's reality. And I think this reality is going to really hit us harder in the years ahead. And we're seeing it right now. If you don't have funding and you don't have enough money, it's a zero-sum game. So I'm either going to teach this African-American study or I'm going to have to give it up and teach something else. It's more important to my community, my locality. In Roanoke City, I would say Roanoke City African-American studies is exceptionally important.
Okay. Wayne?
When we talk about value, and I was in school in Georgia, and I remember the American history textbook. And it probably is similar to what they have in Virginia. It portrayed, and we're talking about truth. What's the truth? We never saw the truth about slavery. The pictures you used to see in the textbooks, and I'm not sure they're still there, are this family, this black family, and the husband and the wife are dressed very nicely, and the kids have on their little knickers, and each have these little briefcases and suitcases. It didn't happen that way, and we've got to tell people the truth.
That's right. Right.
And people have to understand, because they still think this was the best thing that ever happened to those hundreds of thousands of Africans that were brought over to this country. It was not the best thing.
Yeah. And to me, as we were talking earlier about some of the heroes in Roanoke City, is to take that adversity and see how the African-American community has done heroic things to deliver what they've delivered and teach that. Yeah.
Catherine, you had something?
Again, I happened to see one of those textbooks. I was raised in the Midwest, but I happened to see a textbook not long ago, and it had a gentleman that was supposed to be African coming from on the ship and coming off with a stovetop hat, and a briefcase. And I thought, so far from what we know, of course, really actually happened. But I think about when you get to have the truth, I look at the fact that we've had people that were in the military, the Tuskegee Airmen, who did things for this country. You know, we have others who have done a lot to design, Benjamin Banneker designed D.C. in the streets and how it goes in circles. A lot of things that we do every day that we had no idea if you don't take the time to understand how those beginnings actually were and what brilliant people really actually came into this community and being able to make a difference. And I think that's the piece that we want to be able to not forget, that not everybody came out going to school right away, but they had an opportunity. They saw something, they had the passion, followed through on that whole thing. And again, with funding, we know a lot of things get scrapped. It's like in business. I think every time you had a budget cut, you have to get rid of the PR side of it or whatever. Something always gets thrown to the bottom and you have to go back in and try to get that elevated again for the good of all.
Well, and the policies, they change. I remember when it was like, why do we need shop and this technical stuff? Mm-hmm. We don't need that anymore. That's 1950s. And we're right back now, and we're in 2026, and we need way more of that. Right?
I mean, right, that's true. Way more.
Yes. Way more.
Yeah, that's really
true. Yeah, Mike.
William, that's a tension I've seen play out just as long as you have between training and education. And so the distinction I'm trying to make, those two terms are training to prepare you for a skill set and an employer, education preparing you for life and human being.
That's an interesting distinction.
Mm-hmm. Wayne.
I wanted to follow up on my comment earlier. I actually grew up a good part of my life in military. My father's in the military, so we went to military schools in Turkey and all over the place. When I got back in the 60s.
You mean schools for military or military schools where you wore a uniform and all that?
No, a school for military children.
Okay, I got you.
And when we got back, we moved down to an area south of Atlanta, and I'm walking around asking my mother, why are there water fountains? Why are there four bathrooms? Why? And she said, well, son, that's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. But if you look at it, I mean, I had a black teacher when I was in the fourth grade. And I can't imagine that happening back in the 60s in the South.
Right, right. All right. Well, it's time for us to wrap up. Any final thoughts before we close the books on this education? Yes.
Yeah, not about the topic today, but just about the format where we've taken a couple sides of a serious issue and presented a couple different points of view and tried to collaborate on a level of understanding. Isn't that what we're here to model, isn't it?
I think so. I've enjoyed it. I tell you, I always learn more about every issue we discuss. And I think that's part of what the beauty of the fabric of the country is. If we will listen to each other to the point and collaborate, which is sort of what we're trying to do, the finished product is probably better. So that's all that we have time for. You've been listening to the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show on Radio IQ, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose. You can follow us at our website at roanokecollaboration.org, and there you can view our constructive dialogue pledge. Thanks for listening.